Kevin.
Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I'm trying to look for... Sorry, I don't know how to use this very well.
You're doing fine. Generally, we do an audio chat only, so no video is good.
Oh, okay, perfect.
I mean, if you want me to turn my video on and wave hi, I'm happy to, but otherwise we're good.
No, that's totally good. I just wanted to make sure I was giving you the whole experience, if that's what you want.
It's good. It's an audio recording, so.
Okay, perfect.
Well, if you're ready, let's get started.
Ready.
Oh, what was that noise?
Oh, I was moving the computer to a more convenient place.
Alright, are we good?
Yeah.
Cool. Alright, well, hey, let's start with your year of graduation and your major.
So I graduated Berkeley in 2006, and I was a vocal performance major, and I studied songwriting.
Is that like a songwriting major with vocal principal, or is that like a performance major with some songwriting classes?
Yeah, it was... wow, it's been a while. I think it was actually a songwriting major, but I think I had to choose an instrument. My instrument was voice, but my degree was in songwriting.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
And I assume that was the spring of Essex?
I went through the summer, so I graduated... Yeah, yeah. Walked in the spring, but I took classes through the whole summer.
Very good. All right. Well, hey, tell us about your current job or jobs. We'll get to your history later. But what do you do? And let's say start with the one that pays the most money. So I think you do two things, right?
So I only have one job. I am a doctor of clinical psychology. I am a clinical psychologist, and I work in private practice, in a lovely office in downtown Chicago. So my work right now, I spend about 20 to 25 hours a week seeing individual patients for therapy. I work with typically emerging adulthood populations. So millennials are a lot of the people that I see in my office now, but all the way up through middle age is kind of within my...
Emerging adult is like 18 to 25.
Yeah, that's a pretty good definition right now for emerging adults. So a lot of college age, post-college, post-graduate school individuals that I'm seeing. So that is it. I do also teach as a professor, as adjunct faculty. I teach doctoral students studying psychology here and there as well, but primarily I'm just doing the private practice.
Now, as your private practice, sometimes I know private practices have multiple people in a group, or are you in a group of some sort, or totally on your own, and then do you have any like secretarial or administrative support?
No, it's a group of maybe five of us, and we share an office space and collaborate together on a lot of the administrative duties and things like that. But it's a 100% a clinical practice. We all see our patients, and we don't have a staff for additional duties. It's something that the practice owner takes a lot on, and we also all contribute as well. So we're all very invested and connected to the whole process there.
Now, you mentioned there being a practice owner. So is this the, I'm just curious as to how that's structured. In other words, was this just like a roommate type situation where essentially you're all equals? Or is this like what most of us think of as a job that at some point somebody hired you and could fire you?
Nope. I'm an independent contractor. I work for myself. I set my own hours. I choose who I want to see. But there is an owner of the practice space. So essentially, I do what I want, but it's in a commission kind of situation, to where a percentage of each session that I see goes towards maintenance of the space, rent, things like that.
Understood. And I know that some psychologists, like my mother was a psychotherapist, so I have a little familiarity with the profession.
Great.
I know that some psychotherapists, let's say, are very generalist and see lots of people, and then there are ones who, you know, specialize all the way to eating disorders or
right.
Something like that. What's your field within psychotherapy or
sure. Yeah, so I do identify to some level as a generalist. You know, I don't ascribe to a very specific nature or, you know, way of practice. I'm very fluid by nature. I have a very wide lens, so I tend to connect well with a very wide range of people. But I do have a couple areas that are particular interest areas of mine and that I have had the most experience with. So a lot of my work is with psychological trauma, a lot of survivors of abuse, chronic trauma. I also work with a lot of people who identify with non-majority sexual and gender identification. So a lot of work with
That's
LGBT
population.
Yeah, I think it's important. I think sometimes it feels really challenging to just be labeled as a letter. So I think, you know, things that aren't as mainstream. I really enjoy giving safe spaces to and creating room to foster a sense of pride and acceptance around whatever various identities we might carry that might not be celebrated in the mainstream as well. And third, so of course, because of my background, I have this unique sort of connection to the arts and to different mediums of expression. So I work a lot with people in the arts, the creative types, you know, artists, and I do sometimes, I have not as much right now, but throughout my training and career, I have spent a lot of time and research working with using songwriting as a medium of therapy and as kind of a cathartic means for moving through trauma specifically. So that's a really unique thing that I think I'm able to bring to the field, thanks to Berkeley.
I'm sure you're aware that Berkeley has a music therapy major.
I do, and what I do is pretty different. So I was able to combine two really intense studies. So songwriting is a very small thing, and then also the very long process of becoming a psychologist and kind of that ability to, you know, to work with clients into what I think is sort of a unique angle. I do some work with adolescents who've undergone trauma and have used some of the techniques that are very specific to Berkeley, actually, and a particular professor there. And it's been incredible. It's been really incredible with helping people communicate and put words to things that maybe weren't as accessible before.
Sorry? Mentioned that it was techniques particular to a Berkeley professor.
Oh, yes, the lovely Pat Pattison.
Okay.
Yes, he's in the songwriting faculty,
yeah,
I believe.
Songwriting and liberal arts. I think he's officially in the liberal arts department, which is my department.
Oh, wonderful.
He also still teaches songwriting. And he's still there.
Well, I'm so happy to hear that. He was a very major influence on my writing, but also, little did I know, on my whole career trajectory.
That's very nice. So, that's a question. Getting back to your private practice. Excuse me. So, being independent, I'm sure, yes, different insurances pay a different rate, so I've heard. But more or less, your income for the week or the month is a strict function of how many clients you see.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah.
It's.
That's also sort of like as a contractor. If you decide to take a few weeks off, that's great. That's a few weeks you don't get paid.
Right, exactly. So that is one new challenge of being an independent contractor. But you know, it's also part of the reason I really enjoy working with other clinicians. So I decided to do that, actually. I spent most of the month of May traveling in Nepal, and I wanted to make sure, you know, my clients were insulated and had support, and they were able to see a therapist in my interim. And, you know, I had the support available with the clinicians in my practice who could step in. But financially, yes, it's a different way of thinking about it. You have to be very aware of, you know, how that works when you take time off. But for me, being able to be so in charge of my schedule and really to a fair extent, I'm very in charge of my income because it's just dependent on how many people I'm willing and able to see. That's worth it.
I was going
to
ask, how do you get clients?
How do I get them?
Yes,
referrals?
Yes, how do you end up getting clients? Do you advertise? Does everybody pour in? Do you get far more people wanting to see you than you can handle? Do you have ads in the local GLBT publications? I was just curious as to, I'm sure being independent contractor, part of your job, I assume, is finding more people.
Yeah, we're very lucky as a practice that's not hard. We're very fortunate to be full pretty much consistently. So one of the ways that we advertise, if you can call it that we make ourselves kind of public and known, is through a national website. It's very popular. It's how most people find a psychologist. It's called psychologytoday.com. And if you go there and you type in, it's the same thing. Yes. So if you go onto their website and type in your zip code, all of the therapists in your region come up and you can look at their picture and contact them. So it's become pretty well known, so people know to go there when they're looking for resources. So our practice and our profiles are listed there, so I can be found through that realm. But actually right now I have taken that profile down because I am not able to take anybody new at this point.
That's
which
a
is
nice
a wonderful thing,
have.
But it is a nice problem to have. Part of the way I operate is from a very long-term, insight-oriented depth model. So I'm not seeing people for 10, 20 sessions and then, fixing problems and sending them out the door. I work on very long-term sort of relationship building and understanding our own processes and how we relate to ourselves and others. So, excuse me. It's coming on my computer, and I don't know what this is. I'm sorry. It's like actually texts. I have no idea how that's happening. I have people that I'm seeing. I've been having people that I've been seeing for a year or more, and they stay. So a couple of the people I have, many of the people I have on my caseload have been connected with me for. We're talking years, so they don't leave, which is something that in the way I operate, it's a very typical thing to sort of have a long-term relationship with therapy. We keep changing, so we have more opportunities to learn about ourselves. So that's one way. And then also, oftentimes it's just word of mouth. So if you're working with somebody and it's working and they know people in their own circles who are seeking therapy, well, people share their experiences and we have a lot of people come through that way.
Gotcha. Hey, can I just ask, generally paid through insurance or do people pay out of pocket?
I would say most people do pay for insurance, so that is typically the way it happens. Sometimes people do pay out of pocket, but it's a lot less frequent. As providers, you have the option of paneling with numerous amounts of insurance companies, and there's a huge range of reimbursement. So one insurance company might pay X amount of money for a session, another might pay half of that. So unfortunately, in mental health specifically, a lot of providers choose to only accept very high paying reimbursement insurance plans, making it somewhat inaccessible to a lot of people. So something I'm very proud of, and I believe in very much, a lot of my work focuses on social and economic equity. We, as a practice, accept most all national insurance plans, which makes it much more accessible to most people. So therefore, most people do end up using their insurance.
Gotcha.
For us.
I do have one other question about your group that you work with. First of all, does it have a name?
Yes, it's called Mindful Path, and the website is mindfulpathbhw.com for behavioral health and wellness.
Mindful Path BHW.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Are the other therapists that Mindful Path, are they also, let's say, specialized in similar areas to you? Like, are you the place to go for people with...
So... Sure, good question. We have a very large range of practitioners. So we have master's clinicians. We have somebody who works with alcohol and drug use and more, specializes more with addiction. We do have someone who works very well with eating disorders. So we have a pretty broad range of our specialty areas.
But In other words, you're like, oh, this is your problem. The best person to see would be.
Sometimes, if we get, usually people seek us out pretty individually, but yeah, if they just reach the practice, I typically get referrals that are specific to me, but yes, if they come through the practice, we can kind of talk as a group to see where it might fit best. But the unifying piece there is that we all are practitioners of mindfulness and very, very mindful-based kind of presence, and we all use parts of that within our work and within our personal lives. So it is a place that does tend to pull for people who are seeking a space that highlights the value of taking pause and being aware and connected to the present moment. That can be a pretty powerful tool in getting us out of our anxious mind and our thoughts,
Sure. So now, if you wouldn't mind, you talked about how you, at least with some people, use a type of songwriting as therapy. Would you mind going into just a little more detail on that?
Of course, sure. So when you do, a program like mine, a doctorate in psychology, you're doing many years of practica along the way where you are in the field working with people. And one of my first placements was in Cook County Jail. This is a correctional facility in Chicago. And I was working with incarcerated women who had all experienced trauma of some kind prior to their incarceration. And this was a really new environment for me and something that really ignited a passion. And I found the power of music to be just incredible in that setting. I'd walk through the dorms of the jail and the women would be just singing and using percussion on their tables, and it just there's such a sense of expressivity. And I was thinking, how in my own life, as I'd gone through experiences and really difficult times, of course, song had been such a release for me, and I didn't really understand the biomechanics of maybe why that worked. I just kind of knew, so because I'd lived it. So I started working with these women and just kind of meeting with them and starting to think, okay, what could we do that could be healing here? How do we get all of these people? My job, I was working with them in a group, and the idea was to, what can we do as a group to build solidarity and positive interaction, to build self-esteem? How do we do this? And so I thought, okay, what if we write a song together? What if we write a group song? Okay, I've got all these tools in my tool belt. I know what I can do here, but how would we go about this? And basically, it started a whole process for me of diving into the world of research into what it actually does to your brain when you are using music and then applying song and lyric. It's very different when you are vocalizing and using words and kind of the prefrontal cortex sort of stuff, when you're applying that on top of something that's musical, incredible things happen. So I can talk a lot about that. I just don't know how clinical you want me to get right now.
Well, I was curious, maybe less about the science of it, and sort of like how you describe to a layperson what you do with one of your clients.
Yeah. So, well, I only use that kind of technique if it's really something that's going to make sense for them. So just because I have the background, it's not something that everyone has a natural draw to. But, you know, for instance, I was working with a client some years ago, and she had gone through a pretty significant trauma, and it was very difficult for her to put words to. In fact, she didn't have much clear memory of what had happened, and I didn't want to push her in any direction, but I was finding it was difficult for us to connect because she was, really, really struggling to express herself. So I brought in my computer one day, and I just said, let's try something new. Oh, is that a cat?
I have six cats.
Oh my gosh, that's my dream home.
One of whom always seems fit to announce herself when she gets near. But
yes. I love her.
So you were saying somebody where you were having kind of trouble connecting because they weren't very expressive about their history.
Yes. So I pulled up my computer and I said, all right, so I'm going to lay down. I'm just going to put some, I got Open GarageBand. I put some kind of like beats down and had some stuff. And I just, it starts with, so Pat Pattison has this technique called object writing. It's used in the songwriting world. And the idea is you take an object, like it literally can be anything. It could be, you know, we'd call out in class and say, coffee or Tennessee, skyscraper. It's irrelevant. You pick whatever it is. And then you sit down, and we would do this in our classes, at Berkeley. We'd sit down and for, 5-10 minutes, just free associate, just write whatever comes to mind about that word or phrase. And the only thing you think about is what's the sensory experience. So how do we, if the word is coffee, okay, so whatever comes to mind, how does that relate to senses, taste, touch, sight? What are you seeing in this? What are you visualizing? And it's just kind of a way to exercise the creative muscle and get imagery to pour out of you, which can then be the fodder for song. So I found that this became a really amazing way to get a window into someone's psychological experience because, it was so cool at Berkeley. If you were sitting in a room of 10 students and you're object writing around the word coffee, well, every single person's story was completely different and tapped into a whole, unique experience that nobody else would have ever thought of. So in that way, in sharing, you would get to know a part of someone that you never would have known just by asking questions because it was coming so purely from their experience. And so that really stuck with me. And I thought, oh my gosh, if I can use that in a creative way with patients, with clients, that's going to give a window into where people really are. And also kind of be put in this way that feels safer. It's not like we're talking about what happened in a really difficult time of life. We're using creativity. We're putting our experience onto a word or a phrase. So, I did this. I did this with many clients, but this one in particular, and we picked something, it was something in the room, and I had her just write, and she went for just, 10 minutes just connecting and associating to this phrase. And by the end of it, and I did it too, and we shared with one another. And by the end of it, sure enough, hers was just chock full of these beautiful images that reflected a lot of the pain that she'd been carrying. And I pointed that out and I said, wow, I know you sing and look at this, look at this piece right here. Doesn't that sound like it could be such a great line, for a verse? And she was like, yeah, that sounds really cool. And, we didn't get into, it's very clear that this lyric relates to your brother. We didn't even go there. It was just, let's use what you're putting forth. And we did this over and over, and I would work with her in GarageBand and kind of use my songwriting toolbox to help, create it, the form and teach rhyme scheme and all of that. So very long process and story short, by the end of several weeks, we had created an entire song, and it was a representation of her psychological experience that nobody else would have had any ability to know, she gave that forward. And after that, then we got to start the more traditional talk therapy aspect of it, where we looked at it and, you know, reflected and kind of took it apart, and it gave her a safe way to see, oh, wow, this has been in me. I've been carrying it, but wow, I also have the tools in me to make it really beautiful. I just made a really cool song about it. And, you know, it got us a lot closer to be able to do better work too. So that's kind of the foundation of it. I did that with the women in the jail. I did that with some clients. And then I also ended up researching the whole kind of process and writing my dissertation and publishing my dissertation on this particular way of using song for therapy.
Gotcha. That's amazing. Gotcha. Okay, so next question. You said you also teach, or you said you work with doctorate candidates?
Yeah, I work with doctoral students, and they are studying, they're doing their PsyD. That's the same degree I have. It's their doctorate in psychology. And as part of that program, you have to have exposure to many different camps of psychology. There's so many ways to conceptualize people, and there's a lot of different histories. So I teach one in particular that I align with. This spring was the first time I started that, and it was wonderful and a great way for me to keep my tools sharp. So
is this like you in a classroom with a dozen people, or is this one-on-one work?
Yep. I had 12 people in the course in the spring, and a lot of it involved. So if we were to kind of say, you know, what's my orientation and how I operate, I come from an existential perspective. So I teach the course from that too. So the course is humanistic and existential approaches to therapy. So a lot of what we did after I gave the history and sort of definitions and, you know, talking about what that means, we did a lot of role plays where we would sit in the middle of the room and I would be the therapist and actually demonstrate, okay, what does it look like if you're an existential therapist? You know, what does it actually look like in the moment? And then have them also role play and help build their skills with how it works. So it was very fun.
Gotcha. Wow, very cool. You teach one class there?
I did. I taught one class in the spring, and I'm hoping to pick some up in the fall.
Hey, if you're comfortable sharing, you might share what they pay for teaching one class.
Oh, let's see. They change it based on how many semesters you've been teaching. So I believe if you're adjunct and it's the first time you're teaching a 15 week course, it's, oh my gosh, somewhere around between 3,000 and 4,000.
Okay. Yeah, that's so definitely like a side job, not the main thing.
Oh yes, no, it's just to kind of keep the wheels sharp, you know, and to be able to work your brain in a different way. So.
Sure.
But you know, I do have a lot of colleagues who will teach exclusively, and, you know, they'll teach many, many courses and sections, and they can make a wonderful life on that. But I much prefer therapy, so I choose to structure it differently.
A person who retired a year ago but taught psychology at Berkeley for many years was like that. He had his private practice and taught one or two courses for a long time.
Yeah, it's a nice balance that way for me.
I know you said you work 20 to 25 hours a week with clients. Do you just sort of mind describing what your typical work day, or if you prefer work week, looks like at your practice?
Yeah. So right now I choose to go in. I like having 3-day weekends, so I don't work Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. So I go in Monday through Thursday. I typically start around noon, and I'm finishing around 7. Each day I typically see maybe 6 people. So that can range. You know, there's days where maybe it's 7, days where it's 5. But I would say on a typical week it would be Monday through Thursday, maybe noon to 7 with an hour break in there somewhere, seeing about 6 people.
And then apart from seeing the people, is there other time that you're spending doing billing? I knew a friend of mine who's a therapist. That's her big fear.
No, it's really simple. You know, I do, but it's just so minimal. We have a really simple process, and I probably spend for each for each client I see, I write a note after the session and then enter them into our billing database. And, you know, it's just a few minutes, you know, per session. So that's one of the most beautiful parts of the way that this is structured. I don't have any additional time spent. I get to just be fully present to the client and be in the session and kind of briefly write the note and then document anything I might need to and then be ready for the next. So there's very, very little stress in terms of administration or billing. What can be very irritating is when insurance companies are, you know, take a month to reimburse or something. That's incredibly irritating. So, I mean, that's one. You have to have some confidence and faith to take this route because you can't guarantee, even if you see 90 people, I guess I would say that's my average. I probably see 90 people a month. Well, you can't think, well, just because I saw 90 people, I will have the income of 90 people. It might take a month for some of those to come through, depending on what's going on with the insurance end. So it takes a little juggling.
Sure. Another question I have, I can certainly hear your voice and I could put words in your mouth, but let's hear it from you. One criteria you have to meet in order to do these interviews is that you have to enjoy what you do.
Yeah.
So, what is it about your job that you enjoy? Besides the 24-hour work week.
I know. I can't complain about that. My friends hate me.
Go on, please.
No problem. I don't feel like there is anything more meaningful to me, like anything in life more meaningful to me, than sitting in a space with somebody where you're building trust and you're building authenticity. And you're telling the truth, and you're hearing someone's story from an authentic place where oftentimes...
I'm so sorry. Can you hold on one sec?
Yeah.
Hello? Hey, Roni, can I call you back in like an hour? Okay, everything's okay there? All right. Very good. I'll call you back in about an hour. Thank you. I'm sorry about that.
No problem.
I was saying
that I very much value like authenticity of dialogue and conversation, and our world has become so, you know, we ask, how are you? And everyone says, great. Well, how many are great? You know, there's so much more to it. And I get to actually hear people tell the truth, and I get to tell the truth, and I get to be with people in raw, vulnerable moments. And for me, it's a wonderful gift to be able to live authentic moments all day. And a lot of people ask me, like, isn't that so hard to hear people suffering? But the thing that just feels, it's not for me. I mean, some days can be really difficult, but overall, I feel like we all experience moments of suffering. We all can relate to that. There's this universal given that at some point we're going to hurt. So it means a lot to me that I get to just be with people in those moments and also in their joys and in their wins. But there's just such a realness to it. I get to take off the mask and the facade we all have to sort of put on in our world and just be real all day. And I mean, for me, there's nothing that could be more powerful than that. And in a lot of ways, I think that's what music is. And what that was for me was being able to express and tell your true story, and my medium was music, and now it's therapy, and sometimes they combine, and it's very beautiful. But I think that coupled with the relative lack of stress with the job itself, you know, I don't have to, just being able to be so independent, I've certainly found my vocation. It feels like home.
That's very nice. Sure. Right, hey, let's take it next part of the interview. Let's take it back to 2006.
You can
go slightly further back if you need. There you are, finishing your songwriting degree at Berklee. You know, expert singer. Are you thinking, psychotherapist? Was that in your mind then? Where were you at? And let's take your whole path from there to where you are now.
So when I was in high school, I went to a boarding school for performing arts, Interlochen Arts Academy. And I was living there studying flute, and I was kind of being groomed to be, you know, a classical musician. And it really, it was great in a lot of ways, but it just, it was so intense. And so I ended up leaving and deciding, okay, I can't pursue music and, you know, this classical life in such an intense way. I have to find something else. So I went to University of Michigan for my first 2 years of college. And when I was there, I found I was really drawn to experiences, the idea of how people, you know, interpret the world. And I declared psychology as my undergrad. And in doing that, I just found it rather, at the undergrad level, psychology is so, it's so general and labely, and you're just learning kind of history. It didn't really capture my attention the way, I'd hoped. And at that point, I was not willing to imagine committing myself to, a doctorate. I thought, oh my gosh, once I have a bachelor's, there's no way I'm going back to school. So I had one of my best friends was at Berkeley at the time while I was at Michigan. And he was just, I think, the best guitar player I will ever know. I mean, he was just incredible. But he was talking to me, and he had been at Interlochen with me, so I'd known him earlier in high school. And he would just say, Jenny, like, your gift is music. Your gift is, like, telling story through song. He's like, you would be at Interlochen where everyone's doing classical music, and you would be in the practice rooms, like, writing contemporary songs. And, you know, he encouraged me. He said, Berkeley has a contemporary songwriting degree. Like, you got to try this. Like, you know, if you're not happy at Michigan, like, come out here. You know, I'm out here. Like, you got to try this. So he really gave me the courage to try and to leave this really, you know, quote, normal school and go out to Berkeley. And so it was just the best fit ever. Like, Berkeley was my most fun time of life. It just gelled and just came together so perfectly. I had just such a beautiful time there. Like, it just, I will always cherish those years, even though I was only there for two. It was truly the best. And so in my, well, my time had, as I was passing my time at Berkeley, Kevin, this friend of mine, his name's Kevin too, he, unbeknownst to me, was going through some very, very intense personal struggles. And I knew he was pulling away. I knew things were getting very challenging for him, but I had no real understanding. And, you know, unfortunately things turned out to where I still to this day don't have all the details, but he took his life while I was at Berkeley.
I'm sure, was he a Berkeley student?
He had withdrawn before this happened, and had actually been admitted to a hospital, which I'd found out later. And he had been battling, I found this out later too, with a very severe mental illness, and had been being treated on and off for this. And, you know, this was a devastating experience for me. And, you know, he had been sort of my link to coming out to Boston and to Berkeley. And I really struggled with this, but also
to Berkeley.
So, and I carried a lot of guilt around it because I had been kind of harsh on him. Like, hey, I moved all the way out here. Where are you? You're not even really hanging out with me. And, you know, little did I know how much he was suffering. And it really kind of sparked this mission in me, you know, to where I just felt like, man, I have to sort of live for Kevin, put a little part of him in me too. And I want to carry this forward. And he was such a bright star, and my God, was he talented. So, as I graduated, you know, I was still reeling from all of this because that happened in the summer of 2005. And so the next year I'm, you know, with my degree, I moved to New York City, and I had recorded, an album, and I was working on my second album. And, a lot of my songs were about Kevin, about his life, about his loss, about my anger, about my fear, just my confusion over how did I lose one of the most important people in my life and not see it coming.
And I hate to take this mundane really quick. You're in New York. Are you just like doing all music, or do you have some other jobs?
Yeah, I worked at Cherry Lane Music Publishing. I worked in music publishing for a couple years in the royalties department. So I was working on accounts like Elvis and the Black Eyed Peas. So my job was to get their royalties distributed correctly. And then, you know, I was also gigging and playing shows and working on recording my own stuff.
Like you got the job at Cherry Lane?
I do actually. Okay, so my very first job in New York was at Bug Music. It was another music publishing company. And somehow, I can't remember if it was with, I feel like it was with Henry Gaffney. Somebody took us to New York and kind of toured us around on some different locations and companies. And I don't remember, but I do remember Berkeley, a professor or two kind of took a group of songwriters out, and we went around and looked at some stuff. I think that was connected. Yes, that is connected to how I got Bug. So I was hired at Bug. It wasn't a great fit. And so I had started interviewing at other, companies, and within the year I had
just
moved
like
over
putting
to
out applications.
Another Berkeley grad, Hadar Orshalimi, she was at Cherry Lane at the time, and she was really trying to get me over there so we could be together. So she was a big reason why I got my in over there.
Resume, she passes it in. Got it. Okay, so sorry for that detour. So there you are at Cherry Lane.
At Cherry Lane. And but, you know, writing, doing all of my stuff, and then I just was witnessing from the publishing end sort of the collapse of a lot of things that I was working towards in terms of, oh, okay, so being a staff writer for an artist isn't really a thing in the way it used to be. And, you know, it was turning so digitalized, and there was kind of this monopoly on, you know, all the things you sort of, some of the parts of the dream that I thought were there were changing. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to change in the ways the industry was going. And I also started realizing, to be a songwriter and to sort of do what I wanted to do, it was requiring me to also be a business person and to sort of sell myself and to market myself. And I hate those things. Like, I just want to sit behind a piano and play. So it just was not working. Like, I didn't even really like performing, you know, at all these cool places in the Lower East Side. I just wanted to be in a living room with friends or writing for somebody else. I didn't want this, you know, that kind of, you know, attention. I really like to be the creator, but I don't need to be the performer. And I started noticing that the things that were really important to me were shifting. I just kept noticing that, wow, okay, I'm really using song as my way of coping and grieving and learning. And I'm noticing that people have all these other ways of doing it. And I was really kind of trying to understand, continuing to understand, like, what just happened in this last year. And I just hit a wall where I felt like I need to reevaluate things. I am not fulfilling what I want to do. I'm not fulfilling myself in the way I want. And so I made kind of a bold move, and I just quit my job at Cherry Lane. And I moved back home with my mom in Michigan, and I reevaluated things, and I said, all right, you know, I want to find a way to understand and build empathy and compassion around mental health. I want to do right by Kevin. I want to understand this, and I also want to use my music as my way of, I want to keep it personal, because that's what's been healing for me. I don't want this to be, I don't want my income dependent on my creativity. That doesn't work for me. So I naturally, like, I thought about my history with psychology. I was very moved by what had happened with Kevin and his loss. I felt like this would be a way to keep him connected to me. And so I applied to grad schools, and I really stood out. Yes, and I was told many times at all my interviews that I was their first person that applied for a doctorate in psychology with a bachelor's degree in songwriting. But it was awesome because I really did stand out. People were – they're looking at 100 applicants with a psychology undergrad, and here's this girl with a songwriting degree. It made people's eye go to me, and my essays were so kind of full of this depth of what music and creativity was. It really actually embodies what therapy is, that it was a it's oddly natural segue. And so from there, I chose a school in Chicago that I felt was a great fit. And in 2009, where I did my graduate work is called the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. And I moved there in 2009, and I began the six-year process of becoming a clinical psychologist.
That's a long time. We don't have to go in deep detail, but can you describe, at least give the overview of what you do years one through six?
Yeah, so the first 4 years are coursework and practica. So you're actually in classes on site about half the time, and then the other half of the time you are doing clinical work in a setting that's supervised. And then the scariest day of your life happens on at the end of your fourth year, where you get an email one day and you find out if you've matched or not with a national internship. And you really, really hope that you did. And luckily, you know, I did. And so
you're just in limbo or stuck or something.
There are ways. I mean, it does happen for some where it's the end of the road, but for a lot of people, no. You can reapply. You know, you can get really proactive and kind of create your own internship. There's a lot of hoops, but there's ways around it. But it's by a large margin, and it's a very stressful time for everybody in that time of year. So, I'm really afraid of getting the statistic wrong. It's a very famous statistic when you're going through it. I think it's in the 60s.
Like around 2/3 of people match.
I think so.
A majority, but not an overwhelming majority.
Not right. Enough where you're panicked before you get the email. Yes. And enough to where you don't ask anybody if they matched, because you're going to wait for them to tell you in case they're just crying on the floor.
Oh, wow.
So, it worked out, and then matched. It's a year-long residency. You're working full-time. I was in a university in Michigan called Grand Valley State University.
Is that like a paid residency?
Yep. I mean, pretty minimal. I mean, I would say an internship for clinical psychology is like within like the 20s or 30, maybe 20s. And then the next year, once you finish that fifth year, you do have your doctorate at that point. But in order to be a licensed clinical psychologist, you have to accrue postdoctoral hours, and you typically need around 1,500 to 2,000. So, and that's under supervision. So after that, I moved back to Chicago. I secured a postdoc in another school, and I got licensed after that year.
Does it mean like you're seeing clients, but someone else is in the room?
No, no one's ever in the room, ever, even when you're a trainee. But they're supervising in the way of meeting weekly, talking about cases, you know, checking in, signing off on notes, making sure you're documenting things properly, things like that. So you're checking in very regularly when you are on all of your training years, and then it just keeps getting less and less as you move forward. And then once you're licensed, that's when you're 100% independent, and nobody's seeing what you're doing. So, you know, you hope that you've really got it together by then.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And that was just this past year, 2015, that you got your license.
I became licensed in 2015, yes. Mm-hmm. I finished. So, well, what happens after your sixth year, then you have to take a national licensing exam, which is quite challenging, and that's kind of another hoop. So once you pass that test, then you are able to apply for licensure. So it was a lot of flaming hoops.
Well, congratulations. That's
Yeah, thank you. And it was, I mean, it's nice when you find something that is really worth it. You know, I wouldn't be that committed to something that didn't really fulfill me. So
your practice must have existed before you.
Actually, it was developing pretty much around the same time. Yeah, so I was the counselor at a film school in Chicago called Tribeca Flashpoint College, and I was working with artists and musicians, and it was a incredible fit because of my background and my history with Berkeley. It was such a great school for me to work with because I really understood some of the challenges these people were facing as they were approaching graduation with a film degree and what do you do next? And I got to be, I got to really, you know, share some of my experiences with helping guide people. It was awesome. But it was a 1-year contract. I knew it would be ending, so I was open for new positions. And there is a practice in Chicago that had had heard of me, had heard of what I was doing, had heard of my had heard that I was working at Tribeca, and they reached out to me, and I went over to have just kind of an informational interview with them to talk about what I do and what they do, and to sort of build a relationship for potential referrals, because a lot of college counseling centers have a session limit, and when you've seen someone for, you know, 10-15 sessions, you have to refer out. So sometimes private practices reach out to counseling centers to put their name out there, like, hey, you know, I'm here if you need to refer people. So this psychologist reached out to me in that way, and we chatted, and we didn't have an opportunity for us to connect in any real professional way, but we met one another, and it was great. He turned out to be connected to my current practice owner, who was starting this practice and developing it, and said, hey, you know, I met this therapist, Jenny. I think that she might really fit the ideals of what you're aiming for. And she reached out to me, and I interviewed, and we were just a wonderful fit. And so last April, yeah, I've been there a year and 3 months about, I started my work there. And I mean, wow, within a few months, you know, it was full and bustling, and it's been a dream come true.
Well, that's wonderful. It's great to hear. Okay, let's move on to the third part of the interview. My first question for you, and you have mentioned a little bit in that, you know, object writing, sort of songwriting therapy, but beyond that, what, if anything, is your current relationship with music?
I think I protected it a lot by choosing to go into, you know, clinical psychology. I was able to sort of keep music mine in a way that wasn't connected to, oh, I have to be good at this, or I have to prove it. Like, I can just do it. So for me, it's still what I use to get through life. You know, it's still what I use when I can't make sense of the world, when I, you know, when I'm feeling overwhelmed, when I'm feeling overjoyed, you know, just a way to sort of process. I have my keyboard with me at all times. I'll come home after work and just sit and play and see what comes. And I've never stopped writing song, and it's a very personal thing for me. I don't have a need to necessarily share it, but it's a huge part of how I manage and cope with the amount of suffering that I sit with on a daily basis. I then use, you know, music and writing as my release to keep myself in a grounded, balanced place for others.
Gotcha. Very nice. Okay. Next question is, again, you mentioned, of course, the object writings being very useful for your work. Beyond that, of course, the Berkeley gives that Bachelor of Music degree. Is there anything else that you feel that your Berkeley experience did well to prepare you for your current job?
Oh my gosh, so much. I mean, I think that, you know, so many of the psychologists and people who've gone through a more traditional education route with like a bachelor's degree in psychology or sociology, it's very structured. It's very, I mean, there's wonderful things to it, but Berkeley kind of forced me to be out of my comfort zone at all times. You know, you're sitting in classrooms with, you know, incredible musicians, well, you know, a range of musicians, some being very amazing, and putting yourself out there, especially in my degree. You know, we'd be sitting in a room with a piano and performing for one another, and you're in a consistent state of vulnerability at a very tender age. And that got me to have to sit with what it's like to be a little bit uncomfortable pushing my own boundaries, and being able to, you know, sit with the fact that the guy next to you is always going to be a better singer, you know, and have to still find a way to connect to your sense of confidence about what you bring to that room. And you know, that's what therapy is. Like, that is what being a psychologist is. It's sitting in the discomfort of not knowing what the next word is going to be. It's like improvising, you know, you have to trust your instinct. And the only way that you're going to do a good job is if you listen. And if you listen and you're present and you focus. And I mean, 100%, I owe most of those skills I have to Berkeley.
Oh, wow. Okay. Anything else? Or that can be, that's good. I was just curious if you wanted, we can move.
Yeah, no, I think that feels
great.
Good.
So, hey, let's turn that question around now, which is, of course, that Berkeley gives that one degree, the Bachelor of Music degree. But when you think back to your Berkeley experience, is there anything where you say, you know, it would have been really great if Berkeley taught me this, and they could have, and they didn't?
Oh.
And you wish Berkeley had taught you that was missing.
Had I gone into music professionally, perhaps, but I got what I needed out of it. Like, Berkeley really gave me what I needed. I never have felt like I was shortchanged. Like, it was the experience, you know, of just being in an artistic community all the time. And I felt challenged and pushed and heard. And, you know, normally I can give a list of things. I can tend to be actually, you know, I can be very critical, but honestly, they were just such good years. And I don't have things I feel like I really missed out on in terms of curriculum and things. I remember really appreciating the Nashville trip and going down to Nashville and actually feeling the world and seeing professional writers. Like, I feel like, you know, there was a really good balance of you can do this, you know, but it's going to be really, really hard. And, you know, there was an honesty to that. I feel like I felt very prepared and that was cool. So, you know what? I got to say, I feel pretty, pretty pleased.
That's totally fine. Okay. So, next question is, I mean, you were working in the music industry for a couple of years. Then, as you said, you decided, wait, this isn't me. This isn't what I want to do with my life. And then pretty much you hit what you did want to do with your life. Sounds like almost right.
Yep.
And yes, of course, it's a long graduate program, but you got right on that path and here you are. It's great. As I'm sure you can imagine, there are a lot of recent Berkeley graduates who have not yet found their path.
Right.
And also perhaps some people in their final year at Berkeley staring out into the big scary world. So for either or both of those groups, do you have any advice?
I mean, I think it's, I don't know. It's really, I get it. Like, I so get it. But the thing I feel like I have learned is no matter what you graduate with, it's sort of become the state of things to where a bachelor's degree is just a ticket into the working world. And it doesn't feel very dependent anymore on, you know, unless you want to go into something very specific, if you've got a bachelor's degree education, it opens up so many doors. And I don't think you can really find, I think there's a couple ways you can kind of take the approach of being really open-minded and just sort of taking anything that comes your way, even if it feels completely unrelated. You know, in a way, like Cherry Lane, I didn't want to be a royalties worker, you know, typing numbers. I mean, it was cool to work in that environment, but it certainly wasn't capitalizing on my skills. And I see this working with, you know, college students now. A lot of people that I work with tend to be a bit rigid with, well, that's not what I've studied. I don't want to go into that because it's not my passion. Well, you know, sometimes you don't know what your passion is until you get a little bit of experience. So, you know, a very open mind, a very open heart, and taking opportunities without getting too judgmental of them, that saved me, you know, and it really showed me parts of myself I wouldn't have found. So overall, I think it's just the flexibility, not getting too rigid to some expectation of what life is going to be, because as much as we hold on to ideas and plans, how often do they really turn out? Like, a lot of this is like life throwing us to the wind. And I think letting the wind carry you a bit is a very wise exercise.
Nice. And now let's do a sort of more specific variant of that question, which is, I believe you're my 38th interview, and these interviews are all going up in a big index by career. So people are going to be looking at this, and they're going to be, you know, the people who mostly are going to be listening to this interview are the ones who say, oh, psychotherapist, maybe I'll check that one out. So for somebody who is perhaps considering a career in psychotherapy, do you have any specific advice to them?
Sure. Well, you know, that's so broad. So there's just so many ways you could get involved with psychology. I can speak to if you want to become a psychologist.
Sure.
And,
sure.
You know, I don't know the path of a lot of the other routes, but I do know that the commitment can seem daunting, you know, to come out of a four-year program and then to think, oh my gosh, I have to do, you know, 5-6 more years. Like, that doesn't seem possible. And so one thing that I do recommend is looking for programs that give you the option of an out. So my particular program at the Chicago School offered, so halfway through our program, 2 years in, we received our master's degree in clinical psychology. Some people at that point decided, you know what, that's all I want. I'm okay with some of the limitations, and I feel like I can do what I want with this. And they left. So they weren't committed. They didn't lose all their money, you know. So there are ways to sort of feel it out without the huge commitment. So, you know, that's one thing. But also, the number one thing I would say, if you're ever considering a field of a career in mental health of any kind, is go to therapy. It's so important. And I would never, ever consider doing this work if I didn't know what it felt like to sit in the office of someone, you know, and be on the other side of it. It's so crucial to do your own work and to discover who you are and to be able to have some sense of yourself. And while that's always evolving, there's nothing more valuable than going through the process. You don't have to have something like, quote, wrong with you. That's not how it works. It's about insight building and coming to best understand yourself and how you relate. So I would say, go check it out. See what you learn. Does it feel nice to you? You know, but, you know, other than that, I guess just, for me, it was really helpful researching programs and reading about what's offered. There's such a variety now. There's so many ways of combining things. But the thing that I guess would also say is, well, you can do a master's in social work. You can do a master's in clinical psychology. There's all these different things. The one thing I will say is, and I'm probably biased because I did do the doctorate, but it opens up a level of freedom to create something that you might not otherwise be able to create. You know, I'm able to merge so many things into one, and kind of only have to answer to myself with that. And, you know, that is a really awesome thing. So it's for anyone considering it, I would say I feel very worth just going all the way and like doing it because the payoff is awesome and so fun.
Awesome. Great answer. All right. And we're up to the last question here, which is, as they say, you have the mic and you are being recorded. So is there anything else you'd like to say? Anything you missed?
First of all, if anyone listened to this whole thing, that surprises me, and you're amazing, because I feel like most people have the attention span of 5 minutes now, so thank you for actually sitting down for an hour and 5 minutes. And just that there's so much anxiety and fear that can come with any transition, you know, and just I want to sort of like normalize that when you come out of a program or you're anticipating graduating, you know, you're leaving something that's been structured and feels comfortable and you've probably found your role. You might feel like good at what you do. And it's just so normal to feel like, what the heck do I do now? And it's just something everyone goes through. It's such a rite of passage. And, you know, for people in that place, I just so encourage them to face it and not avoid that fear and shut down, but just to keep plowing through and being open to the adventure, because it's going somewhere if you show up for it. And, you know, Berkeley shaped my life in such a huge way. It's will always be one of my greatest loves. And I continue to see how it's influenced and shaped me. And I'm just very proud to be part of that community. And I'm excited to see who the new folks will be coming out of there. Yeah, that's it.
Well, very nice. Hey, I really enjoyed this conversation, hearing your story here.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. I've appreciated you taking the time to get to know my story.
Absolutely. So, hey, look for a message from me in the near future. And best of luck to you and everything. Sounds like you're on a, you know, in a great place.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, have a lovely evening.
Okay. You too.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.